This is Fresh Air. Ralph Wiley likes to give his books provocative titles. His first collection of essays was called Why Black People Tend to Shout. His new collection is titled What Black People Should Do Now. He tackles subjects like male-female relationships, Afrocentrism, and how the Clarence Thomas hearings divided the African-American community. And he writes about such people as Magic Johnson, Marion Barry, Steven Seagal, and Spike Lee. Wiley co-wrote Lee's book about the making of Malcolm X. Wiley has also worked for the Oakland Tribune and Sports Illustrated. He told me why he gave his new book the title, What Black People Should Do Now.
The title is satirical. I meant to send up people who are offering up pronouncements as to what black people should do now, as if black people were this monolith. I wanted to at first satirize, started off as a satire, and then try to show some of the range of what's going on today. If I were really trying to title the book more precisely or more literally, I would have titled it Semi-Satirical Notes on Popular Contemporary American Culture from a Somewhat Masculine African-American Perspective, and everybody would have dropped dead asleep by the time I'd finished with that title. So this title is intended to, as most of my work is intended to provoke thought. And I think it's the artist's responsibility, because everybody else has got to get a rating or got to get elected or got to get tenure. And there's always these outside influences coloring their perceptions or their responses. And I wanted to give a pure response.
You have a couple of essays that are set in Africa that are about your trips there. Mm-hmm. One of them is called Do All Black People Know Each Other? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of about the expectations that African Americans have of Africans and Africans of African Americans. Mm-hmm. You use two examples of two Africans who you met there who were very different in temperament and very different in the way they related to you. Let me ask you to describe them both.
Well, in the essay, Do All Black People Know Each Other, which, again, it's a satire. It describes a meeting that I had in the Eastern Sahara outside Cairo with a number of African men. It was a group of men. Two of the men were, one was named Mansuru Ofemi Oyeburi. He was a 23-year-old recent graduate of medical school from Nigeria. One of the most handsome men I've ever met in my life. Black as velvet at midnight, bone white teeth, exquisite scarification in the corners of his eyes, eyebrows at a very quizzical up tilt. Beautiful man. And as a matter of fact, I'm pretty much AC myself, Terry, but I looked at this man and said, my goodness, you are a handsome man. And he looked at me and said, I know it. And so it dawned on me, you know, he's handsome, at least in part, because he does not think he's ugly. And he was very quiet. He was listening, and as the rest of us were talking. And one of the most talkative gentlemen was another man named, I won't call his name. He was from Ghana. But he had all these affectations, which really came out of his exposure to the popular, worldwide, really popular culture, popular medium. He was using all these colloquialisms that are part of the dialect of some African-American cities. Yo, what's going on, G? What's up, man? I'll be back here. And it was quite arresting to hear this in the Sahara Desert. I mean, it sort of stunned me. And when I couldn't respond to me, his seeming respect and fascination with me was stripped away, and there was the contempt. There was the contempt that was left.
When you got back, I think it was when you got back to the States,
mm-hmm.
He called you and asked you for like $500 or something to help him with his studies.
Right.
What was your reaction to that, and how did you go about saying no? It's very hard to say no when somebody asks you a favor. Of course, the more money they ask for, the easier it is to say no. But
what was
your attitude about how to handle that and how to interpret the request?
Yes, well, that did happen, and if it had been Mansuru Ofemi Oyeburi who had called me after I got back to the States and asked me for $500, I probably would have sent it to him. You know, because I knew he wouldn't have wanted to ask. But my other friend, he seemed to feel that it was my duty or something. Or he wanted to make me feel as though it were my duty. And I'm so accustomed to fighting against manipulation of any sort that it was very easy for me to see it.
When you thought he was playing on your sense of duty, duty to do what? What do you think he was trying to manipulate within you?
The bond or perceived bond that he and I would have as Africans. But you see, that still requires, I mean, that's not enough. That's, you've got to have more than that. You've got to have more in common than that. You've got to have a better understanding of each other than just that, than just the perceived point of origin. And that's what I mean by the Afrocentrists and the Eurocentrists. They both equal. If they only knew, they could get together on me. And maybe they could come together over me.
Throw your surprise party.
Right. But that's kind of what I'm trying to do. If the artist allows himself or herself to be the lightning rod, you're hoping that people will think through or think beyond their emotional response and might even see what they have in common.
Do you feel that you are often pressured to, like, choose a side to be in a camp, whether it's, like, the Afrocentric camp or the more Eurocentric camp, or whether you should be siding with the black man or the black woman? And do you know what I mean? Do you feel that you're trying to kind of steer a course that doesn't deal with sides but just deals with your point of view as you see it?
That's exactly what I'm trying to do, Terry, is to do exactly that and to show and to live out that you should trust no ideology blindly.
No, what are the pressures from
everywhere
camps?
I go, depending on the crowd, you see, depending on their precious little turf that they're trying to defend, it could be because I'm sending up the elite white power structure. I'm sending up the black grassroots leadership. I'm sending up the Afrocentrists. I'm sending up the Eurocentrists. I'm sending up black men. I'm sending up black women. I mean, everybody's turn comes. And when your turn comes, yes, it's gonna sting a little bit.
My guest is Ralph Wiley, author of the new book, What Black People Should Do Now. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Writer Ralph Wiley is my guest. You've written a lot about sports over the years. You were at Sports Illustrated for 9 years.
Right.
Now, your grandfather and your uncle, I believe, were both prize fighters.
Right.
Were they celebrities in their neighborhoods?
Not at all.
Really?
Interesting question, Terry. Not at all. No more so than the mortician, or probably less. In fact, my uncle was a vagabond, indigent. I mean, always stuck to his knitting, been married to the same woman for 20 years now. Custodian, who now cleans out the schools that he once decided not to attend because he had found what he thought was his calling at the age of 15, despite my grandfather's insistence on the saving propensity of the liberal arts. He was the one of my uncles and aunts who didn't particularly take that to heart. He took a different sort of life to heart. But it was odd that the liberal arts then, the first book I wrote, Serenity, a Boxing Memoir, is largely a homage to him. He was frozen by those same liberal arts in a book.
Now, you've written about boxing over the years. How do you think having prize fighters in your family affected your views on what is probably the most controversial sport?
If indeed we can call boxing sport.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure that we can. I think it's a bit of a stretch. But at the same time, it's just been fascinating ground for me as a writer over the years. Muhammad Ali, who I write about in What Black People Should Do Now, I write about him as sort of a harbinger more than anything else. I mean, here's this man in the early 60s, very handsome man, standing up, just an exemplar of manhood, saying, I am the greatest, I am pretty, I am beautiful, I am a bad man. I mean, the effect that had on me as a 10-year-old, 12-year-old is probably incalculable. Again, not that I wanted to be a boxer, but when I was a copy boy at the Oakland Tribune at the age of 23, making the late milk runs for the late papers at 3 a.m., I would I would go over to IBM's Electric Typewriters and put in a fresh piece of paper and just type, Ralph Wiley's the greatest sports writer in the world, bar none. Ralph Wiley's the greatest sports writer in the world, bar none. Ralph Wiley's the greatest sports writer in the world, bar none. And that's the way that I was influenced by him or by the boxers. Just as I think, I hope that Michael Jordan was a harbinger of today. In this way, an excellence, a harbinger of an excellence, of an expansion of the human envelope on capability. Because when I grew up, only the last man in the line could dunk, and he had to be very unreasonably tall. He had to be 6'10", 6'11". This is white or black. But there was a man named Julius Erving who preceded Michael. Michael was a young man, much as I was a young man with Ali. And Julius Erving, he says, Michael Jordan as a young man saying, this is possible. Now I will add what I can do to what is possible, and perhaps the envelope will expand. Now, he's not saying this consciously, much as I never wrote those words consciously referring to Ali. But I think this is how human endeavor is inevitably moved forward.
You went to segregated schools growing up in Memphis, and then you chose to go to a small black college, a college that isn't very well known.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you were offered a scholarship to one of the Ivy League schools and turned it down?
Yes. I write about this whole education issue in an essay in the book entitled Why Black People Sing the Blues. And it has to do with the very relevant issues of hate speech as opposed to free speech on college campuses now. And that's really the jumping off point of the essay. And yes, I guess in point of fact, you can say I went to segregated schools, but also the white children in Memphis went to segregated schools.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we all went to segregated schools, but somehow I'm the one that's supposed to carry the pathology. This is very common. You know, everybody was segregated, not just me.
Well, in your first collection of essays, Why Black People Tend to Shout, you have an article about integration in there. And in a lot of ways, you think integration has been a bum rap for African Americans.
Well, Terry, I think the integration was handled badly. The perfect analogy, I hate to keep going back to sports, but the perfect analogy is when the major leagues were integrated in 1947 with Jackie Robinson. And it was put forth as this great social experiment, and actually a lot of people didn't like it. But it was not institutional integration. It was integration of a sort of a talented 3% or something. And that led to the demise of the institutions of the Negro League-owned baseball team. So instead of including the Kansas City Monarchs and the Homestead Grays in the major leagues, you know, the top 10 or 18 or 20 ball players were taken, and naturally these other teams died. They folded. And a very similar thing happened in the way integration was implemented in the country. I mean, I've always preferred desegregation. I mean, you can't force people together. What you can do is force a sense of equality and a sense of equal access.
Further the analogy for me. You made the analogy of how the black baseball teams died out after the best players, and only the best players, made it to the major leagues. Further the analogy in terms of what you think has happened to certain neighborhoods.
Well, like S.A. Owen Junior College, where I grew up, from ages 2 to 11, that's sort of a young mascot. It's not there anymore. There's a junior high there with no windows that can be seen from the street. There were theaters all over inner cities. There was a movie theater across the fence from my backyard in Memphis called the W.C. Handy. And I would go up there every weekend and watch very forgettable films. But I do remember The Magnificent Seven. But
oh, great film.
but most of those theaters have been closed down now. And if you look at any major city, you can see that theater now, and then 9 times out of 10, it's closed. Some of the best high schools potentially in the country were closed down, were forgotten, were left in disrepair, and only the worst teachers or the worst principals and all the talented students were taken out. So then what you have left is just not a great environment, and people say, oh, look at this. Well, there's a reason. There's reasons that these things happen. And I just think I'm really trying to get people. I mean, I have a lot of humorous lines in the book, but even the humorous lines are intended to make you think.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, Terry, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Ralph Wiley is the author of the new book, What Black People Should Do Now, Dispatches from Near the Vanguard. This is Fresh Air.